This joint Migration Policy Institute and International Organization for Migration event convenes a discussion on the recently published handbook titled Developing a Roadmap for Engaging Diasporas in Development. Speakers include Andrew Bruce, Regional Director for IOM in the Asia-Pacific, Dublin Ranviega-Gunas, IOM's Regional Research Officer and MPI Policy Analyst, Todd Cleaver, Deputy Head of Mission for the New Zealand Embassy in Bangkok, Thailand, Dr. Nopawan Thanpipat, Vice President of the National Science and Technology Development Agency, and Kathleen Newland, Director of MPIA's Migrants, Migration, and Development Program. And now, here's Andrew Bruce.
Good evening, everyone. It is my distinct privilege to welcome you here tonight to the Foreign Correspondents Club to launch our most recent publication, Developing a Roadmap in Engaging Diasporas for Development. The topic of diasporas has been gaining attention recently on many fronts. I was in Tokyo on Sunday, where you will have heard that there was an important meeting on the future of development aid to Afghanistan. In its development, the Afghan diaspora, those who left Afghanistan and are now living and working abroad, as well as their children and children's children, who may have never been to Afghanistan, can play an important role in that development. As centers of remittances, as direct investors in industry, as philanthropists, as sources of skills and knowledge, and as the setters up of networks between Afghanistan and the countries they reside in. And the same observation can be made concerning almost all countries here in our region, whether we are talking about Myanmar or China, Singapore or India, and of course also Thailand. Diasporas can and do play a positive and important role in facilitating growth and development of their countries of origin. And governments and many other actors, including the private sector, are aware of this. The question now for many of us here is not so much whether diasporas can benefit their countries of origin, but how they do so, and what kinds of policies and programs can foster these relationships. What is the appropriate role for governments, international organizations, and other actors in harnessing diasporas towards the development of their countries? For IOM, we consider members of the diaspora as an important partners. In fact, next year, we are planning to convene a ministerial meeting in Geneva to discuss diaspora contribution to development and how this can be enhanced. And I dare say many of us here this evening are members of a diaspora. I am a member of the New Zealand diaspora, and New Zealand has a large diaspora in proportion to the size of its population. To give us some insights into efforts New Zealand is making to benefit from its diaspora, we are most fortunate to have the Deputy Head of Mission of the New Zealand Embassy here in Bangkok, Mr. Todd Cleaver, who will give us some insights into how New Zealand is harnessing its diaspora. I hope that you will find the handbook useful in your work. It is a unique reference guide providing synthesis and analysis of the results of many governments' efforts to encourage their diasporas. And is a product of IOM's partnership with the Migration Policy Institute, or MPI, which is one of the leading think tanks on migration in the world today. And I'm very happy that Kathleen Newland, MPI's director, is here with us this evening. I look forward to a fruitful discussion, and with that, let me close with my thanks and appreciation for your presence here this evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andy. As Andy has told you, I'm Kathleen Newland from MPI, the Migration Policy Institute, which is an independent, not-for-profit, nonpartisan think tank based in Washington, D.C., where we devote ourselves to the study of the movement of people worldwide. And my special focus in these last few years has been on the relationship between migration and economic development. And in that, within that field, one of the things we have zeroed in on as being really critical to the relationship between migration and development is the role of diasporas. So it's really a pleasure for me to be here back in Bangkok to introduce you to this handbook called Developing a Roadmap for Engaging Diasporas in Development. And I hope that you've had a chance to pick up a copy in the back of the room. In a few minutes, I'm going to introduce my colleague, Dublin Agunias, who is both a regional research officer at the IOM regional office here in Bangkok and a policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute in Washington. So we are sharing her, and this handbook is one of the products of that partnership, which we are very, very pleased to launch today. Some of the other products of that partnership you've seen displayed on the screen if you've been paying attention to it. Dublin has edited, is editing a series of issue briefs, another joint IOM-MPI publication on a very interesting series of topics. The next one will actually look at the migration experience in the aftermath of the war in Libya, which overthrew the Gaddafi regime and had enormous repercussions for migrant workers, of whom there were hundreds of thousands in Libya. After Dublin presents some of the highlights of the sort of findings and conclusions and introduces you to some of the special features of the handbook, we are going to have comments from two guests whom I'm very, very pleased to welcome today. Andy has mentioned that his compatriot, Todd Cleaver, is here. Todd is the Deputy Chief of Mission of the New Zealand Embassy in Bangkok, and which represents New Zealand to Cambodia, Laos, and Myanmar, as well as to Thailand. Then we're going to have a comment from Dr. Nopawan Thanthipat, who is a quantum chemist. I hardly even know what that means, but it's very impressive. And she had a distinguished career as a chemist in the United States before returning to Thailand under the auspices of the Reverse Brain Drain Program, a program which she now directs in her capacity as Vice President of the National Science and Development Agency of Thailand. And I'm really thrilled to welcome both of them. I hope you'll allow me just to say a few things about the handbook before I introduce Dublin to really give you an impression of the heart of it. Both MPI and IOM have worked on diaspora issues for many years and have recognized the important role of diasporas as development actors. As Andy said, not just as senders of remittances, but in many other roles, philanthropy, innovation, first movers in a lot of industries, ranging all the way from tourism to high-tech industries. And this handbook is the product of a long process of study and policy analysis and policy development on the part of both our organizations. In a way, you can trace the evolution of the handbook back to a meeting that I had with a couple of members of a diaspora in Washington who came to MPI along with representatives from their embassy in Washington. And both the diaspora members and the diplomats had been tasked by their capital to come up with a plan for engaging their diaspora for the benefit of development in their country of origin. And so we sat and we talked for at least an hour, and, you know, I had lots of arcane points to make and gave them a few papers I had written on the subject, scholarly papers. And after a while, they said to me, you know, our policymakers just don't have time to read. You know, they're overwhelmed with responsibilities and are trying to do so many things at once in a relatively under-resourced bureaucracy. They don't have time to read. We recognize the importance of the points that you're making, but could you draw us a picture? You know, give us something that they can grasp just immediately. And I said, well, I can try. and what I came up with somewhat resembles the diagram that you'll find on page 24 of this booklet. I'm not sure it's much more accessible than a scholarly paper because it's a very complicated diagram. But in it, this is what we've taken to calling the roadmap. I think you know, a more scholarly term would be a sort of strategic plan for diaspora engagement. But what we tried to do there was to map out a series of elements that we think every government needs to consider if it's trying to develop a more productive relationship with its diaspora. And there are four major elements there, which, as you can see, we recommend that governments need to really think about why they want to engage their diaspora. And there are lots of possible reasons. You know, some governments are really primarily interested in remittances from the diaspora. Others are interested in sort of luring back their highly skilled expatriates. Some are interested in not in having people come back, but in working with the diaspora to consolidate relations with the country of settlement, between the country of settlement and the country of origin. And this is very important for diasporas who are living in Europe, living in the United States, living in Japan, to really be the ambassadors for their countries. So we recommended that governments really think about why they want to engage the diaspora and try to figure out what capabilities they have within the government to do that and what capabilities their diasporas have. We also suggested that they really need to invest in understanding their diasporas, in sort of a Know Your Diaspora campaign, which involves really collecting and analyzing data about where people are, what they're doing, what their demographic profile is. You know, are they young, old, primarily female, primarily male, family members, single people? You know, what's the profile? Because that makes a great deal of difference in how you can engage people. Then we suggested the most difficult and possibly the most important part of this strategic plan is to build a relationship of trust with the diaspora. And that's really difficult, particularly for those diasporas that have their origins in a refugee flow, for example, or have moved abroad as dissidents, or are several generations removed from when their forebears left the country. But it's absolutely critical for a productive relationship. And if they are successful in building a relationship of trust, then a whole series of steps need to be taken to mobilize the members of the diaspora to take part in the development of their country of origin or ancestry. We don't imagine that this is a one-size-fits-all plan, but we think it's a plan that can be adapted to the particular needs of particular countries. The handbook is meant to be used. We worked hard to make it accessible, to not use bureaucratic language too much, and to make it accessible. And when we launched the handbook recently in Brussels for our sort of European colleagues, an official from the European Union spoke up at this meeting and said somewhat apologetically, you know, I confess I haven't read the handbook all the way through yet. And I was quick to say, you don't have to. You know, this handbook is meant to be dipped into. It's meant to be thumbed through. You'll see there are lots of places where the contents of a chapter are summarized in just a few lines, where key takeaways and sort of key challenges are presented. I think on page 96, you'll find an example of that, where, you know, Dublin started out a chapter with, you know, a basic menu and checklist, a basic lessons learned in just a few words. So we are hoping that any policymaker, no matter how busy, no matter how little time he or she has to read, can dip into this handbook and find something useful. There's a sort of 5-minute version of using the handbook, as well as a 5-hour version for probably the more junior bureaucrats who are tasked with reading it and seeing what's useful. And we hope one day soon that there will probably be a 5-day version as well, where we may work with governments to derive sort of planning sessions or even training sessions built around the handbook. So I've said too much. I want to turn it over to the principal author of the handbook, Dublin Agunias, who is going to take you through some of the main findings. Thanks, Dublin.
Thank you, Kathleen. Good evening, everyone, and thank you to all of you for being here with us today. I actually just returned to Bangkok early this week after being away for almost a month, where I was in 4 different regions of the world. I was in the Middle East in Jerusalem the first week of June, and then immediately after that I was in Mauritius. And then after that, I was in Brussels, and then after that, I went to Manila, all to do one thing, and that is to promote the handbook, but also talk about diaspora engagement. What's really interesting in these trips and being in many different in 4 different places and talking to different people is that when you talk about diaspora engagement, seems to be talking about the same thing. The conversations may be different in some sense, but if you think down to it, very similar conversations. There is, I sense, a very uniform sense of recognition among these many countries about the fact that, yes, there's potential in engaging the diaspora, that that it's important that we engage them and that they could be key development actors. But also I sense this sense of urgency, that maybe we are not doing as much as we should be doing, that maybe we are not doing the right thing when it comes to engaging the diaspora, and that there is so much that we still don't know when it comes to engaging the diaspora. And I was surprised to feel or sense this urgency, not only from talking to individuals in countries that are just beginning to engage the diaspora, you know, such as, let's say, Mauritius and other countries in Africa. I also sense this urgency even when talking to governments that are from governments who have been doing a lot of this for quite a long time, such as Israel, for instance, or Armenia or South Korea. There's this sense that we don't know as much as we need to know. And I think that it is in this context that this handbook will hopefully be useful, because despite all the talk about the importance of diaspora engagement, The Economist just came up with a cover, I think, late last year, which says the magic of diaspora. So there's a lot of talk about it right now, but despite that, there's still a huge gap in the knowledge and the substance. And we hope that this handbook fills some of this gap and assists governments and other stakeholders in sharing knowledge. And I think even more importantly, using this knowledge. There are 3 things that I think makes this handbook a unique resource. And let me run through these 3 features. First of all, much of the information that you will find in this handbook came directly from those who actually do diaspora engagement, not just those who think about it. The handbook builds a lot on the previous work that IOM and MPI has done in this area. But not only that, the handbook was also prepared under the framework of the Global Forum on Immigration and Development. For those of you who don't know, it's the only annual meeting of governments to talk about migration, specifically with its impact on development. So what we did was that we surveyed the more than 140 countries that attend this global forum, and we had a two-part survey. It was answered by 62 governments, and we also conducted in-depth interviews with 35 governmental institutions in English, French, and Spanish to highlight some of the challenges that they face on the ground in rolling out many of these programs, and also did a number of consultation meetings. And also this handbook was vetted at the last global forum that was held in Geneva last December. Second, this handbook is not meant to be exhaustive. It's meant to be selective. That is why the handbook is this thick and it's not this thick. As a writer, I think it's a lot easier to write a long piece than a short one. But there's a serious effort to keep it short. And so we wanted to present a carefully selected menu of viable options and program options based on actual experiences from around the world. We wanted to identify what is the latest thinking on key areas highlighting key areas engaging diasporas. For instance, what is the latest thinking on remittances, on diaspora investments, on facilitating the transfers of skills and expertise? And then we also covered a number of emerging areas which we think is quite interesting and should interest a lot of governments, such as diaspora philanthropy, capital market investments, diaspora tourism. There's also a section in the handbook that talks about the institutional and legal frameworks that governments have created to engage with their diasporas more formally. And we have identified 77 of such institutions, found in 56 countries so far. There's also a chapter on some of the legislations and regulations that encourage diaspora members to engage back home. The last and the third feature of the handbook, which I think you should find interesting, is that this is not just a compendium of policies and programs. The handbook also offers a strategic plan of action for those who are interested in engaging diasporas more fully. That's why we're mentioning the title, a roadmap, so to speak. We do this because sometimes when we think of diaspora engagement, we only focus more on the outcome. So how much diaspora bonds were raised? How many diaspora members returned to their countries of origin? How many return and share their time and expertise? But engaging diasporas is also not just an outcome. It's also the process is also important. And how the policies and the programs and the institutions are chosen and created, how the goals are achieved, are also critical indicators of success. And choosing the road to take is not easy. So if you look closely into the cover, and if you please look closely into the cover, you see a picture of a map, quite convoluted with many roads and twists and turns. I don't know if this is familiar to you, but it is actually the map of Bangkok. And this is the Chao Phraya River. And I must say, when I moved to Bangkok less than 2 years ago, it's not very easy to master the streets of Bangkok. Now, my husband prides himself for being able to drive around Bangkok and to a lot of parts of Thailand without a GPS. But it took quite a long time. It took months of being lost in many little sois in Bangkok. And I think that engaging diasporas is almost like the same experience. And to many governments, as they engage their diasporas, there's just so many opportunities to get lost. And hopefully, the roadmap provides some guidance. It may not be a high-tech GPS, but we hope that it's better than nothing, and it could actually help them arrive at a destination. Let me just end with one thing, and I think we are in Asia, and I would argue we have this launch every part of, I mean, four different parts of the world, but I would argue, and not because I'm Asian, but I would say that if there's any region in the world that is bound to benefit most from the diaspora, it is this region. We have stayed on the sidelines for about 200 years now, and I think that our region has certainly made a huge comeback, so to speak. Many are predicting left and right that Asia will be the world's future strategic and economic center of gravity. And the number says a lot why. Asia is expected to account for more than 40% of global output and world consumption by 2030. We are in the fastest growing region of the world. And I think that migration has been and still is an important feature of this region. And the 50 million Asian migrants who are not living in their country of origin would have a lot of role to play in keeping Asia's ascendancy going. And the challenge now is how to tap into this global knowledge-driven economy. In a knowledge-driven economy, I think the main challenge is not just to access money, and the main challenge is now to access people. individuals with unique skills and ideas and networks. And that is what the diaspora has to offer. So I look forward to a fruitful discussion, and thank you.
Thank you very much, Dovlin. The handbook is certainly not a GPS, but it is at least a living document. I should have mentioned, and I'll mention now, that the entire handbook is available online. It's both on the IOM website and on the MPI website and on the website of the Global Forum on Migration and Development. We also created, because we thought that was all too much to remember, we created a URL for it that is just called the diasporahandbook.org. So if you know anyone you think might be interested who doesn't have access to a physical copy, please refer them to the diasporahandbook.org. And now I would like to turn to Todd Cleaver, who can talk to us about New Zealand's experience and any other observations you may have. Thank you for joining us, Todd.
And thank you very much for being part of this panel. It's a great honor. Swadhi Kap, ladies and gentlemen. New Zealand's a developed country, but very much that we are interested in the diaspora issue. We talk very much about globalization, being global citizens. We live in a world where there's high labor mobility, but we definitely need to be looking to the future and talking about harnessing the wealth. And here I'm not only talking about the financial wealth, I'm talking about the intellectual wealth, the capability wealth, the connections, the cultural links, business partnerships. And this is something where we think that the diaspora can make a very positive contribution to the growth of our country. And definitely within a globalized world, that and with the tools that we have at our disposal now, for example, the web and also all of the social media, this is much easier now than it ever was before. But if I can take an opportunity to thank the authors of this great resource, it's an excellent addition to what we know about diaspora, but also in terms of taking it forward. The statistic in terms of, I think it was 76 organizations across 55 countries, gives you an idea of just how widespread the interest is in being able to harness the benefit from the diaspora is. In terms of New Zealand, to give you a little bit of background, New Zealanders have long had the travel bug, and we see it as being part of our rite of passage, if you like, that people, young people, spend time overseas, in particular at the end of high school or at the end of the university. And this is a way for them to see the world. We occupy a small corner of the globe, and they see the world, and they often will gain experiences that they can't get in New Zealand. Not only the cultural experiences, obviously, which are very enriching, but also on the work front. If, for example, you're a doctor and you want to train, or perhaps if you're a quantum chemist, I'm not sure that we offer that speciality in New Zealand, you'd need to go abroad. And so this is something we have always accepted. And it's grown, it's sort of part of our psyche. To give you an example of all of the friends that I had in university, I'm talking a group of probably 25 people, close friends at a university, a third, all of us went overseas. Every single one of us went overseas, maybe not immediately, maybe 2 or 3 years after university, but every single one went overseas, lived overseas, and worked overseas. About a third of those people returned after 5 years. Another third returned after 10 years. And there's been a sort of a constant trickle back until there's probably about 20% of the people who started off overseas still there. But for us, you can imagine the benefits in terms of these people have gained international experience at a professional level, and they've now been able to bring those skills with them back to New Zealand. But we look at the people who are still overseas and we say to ourselves, well, you know, we would love for them to come back, but if they're enjoying themselves overseas, why not tap into that resource? Why not sort of look at those people and say, well, they are a connection for us into another environment? If I can give you a statistic, New Zealand has a population of just over 4 million people. But the most recent statistic I have is about 5 years old. But at that time, there were over 600,000 New Zealanders living overseas on a sort of a long-term basis. So about 14% of the population. The largest group was living in Australia, our closest neighbour, which makes a lot of sense. But we also had sizable populations of almost 60,000 people in the UK and 35,000 people in North America. And then obviously in terms of Asia, I'd be really interested to know what the statistics are now, but I'm quite sure that the number is large and growing. Interestingly, an international study published a few years ago found that New Zealand had the highest proportion amongst developed countries of its skilled workforce living overseas, and also that New Zealand was second amongst developed countries for its expatriates holding a tertiary education. So we're not talking about a diaspora in a sense that that is an unskilled labour force. We're in fact talking generally about a relatively skilled labour force. Obviously, there's a real discussion that can be had about whether we see this as being good or bad. Interestingly, we don't actually talk about that in New Zealand. It's seen as being a positive aspect. We don't really focus on sort of the concept of a brain drain or anything like that. People go overseas and they gain experience, and if they choose to, they will come back. And we are then able to sort of gain the benefit from that as a country. Also, we can tap into to people when they're offshore still. As an embassy, we have always done this. This in some ways isn't new, and this is done by a lot of embassies that I see the ambassador for Mexico here, and I know that we always tap into our diaspora wherever we are. Normally, though, we tap into it in a way that is looking at particular groups. So, for example, I know from New Zealand, there's a New Zealand Thai Chamber of Commerce here, there's a New Zealand Society, and there's also an Australian-New Zealand Women's Group. All of those groups have different interests and different memberships, but they all add to the value that we as a New Zealand embassy feel here, and also being able to tap into the links that they have. But what we've done in more recent times is we've taken a more strategic look at that, and we've said to ourselves, okay, we have these different interest groups, we have these different people who are all willing to help New Zealand. How do we actually harness this? What do we do? In 2001, there was an organization established called KIA, which is a name of a bird in New Zealand, a kia, but it stands for the Kiwi Expat Association. This is a not-for-profit organization, but one that does receive government funding. Membership is free. And if I can read you what I would describe as the mission statement, it's not actually called the mission statement on their website, but it says, KIA New Zealand is a not-for-profit organization whose purpose is to reach and motivate expatriate Kiwis and friends of New Zealand to increase their contribution to New Zealand, thereby turning them into a strategic national asset. If I can just repeat that. Thereby turning them into a strategic national asset. KIA New Zealand aims to contribute to the economic growth of New Zealand by helping New Zealand become the most globally connected nation in the world. So, although it says turning them into a strategic national asset, I think they are already, but it's just a matter of to make them a usable asset, you need to be able to find a way of harnessing the benefit, the knowledge that they have. So this organization has currently over 32,000 members worldwide. It has chapters, a lot of chapters in North America, that through east through west, chapters in Europe. Here in Asia, it has chapters in China, Guangzhou, Shanghai, Beijing, in Japan, Hong Kong, Singapore. There's no chapter here yet in Thailand. It is being developed, but very much on an organic basis. Although it does have government funding, and we are keen to sort of to spread the outreach, in some ways there needs to be a critical mass. We can't force this upon people. And it would be very easy to try and squeeze people for all of the information that they have, all of the contacts that they have. But that would be a very short-term gain and a long-term loss. The idea is to create an organization where the people themselves find that they benefit from their interactions. So KIA, for example, in terms of its chapters, puts on seminars, it puts on social functions, networking functions, it advertises jobs. Now, if I can put it to you this way, this is interesting because it's a New Zealand government, there's New Zealand government funding for an entity that advertises offshore positions. And this is something that the KIA group themselves find useful, and it attracts them to the organization and builds them as a group, a cohesive group. And that's what we want because that's the most beneficial group that we can then interact with. The chapters are geographical, but there are also a few chapters which are focusing, for example, on IT and on media. So we're looking at this in a more strategic and now a more global way. Perhaps if I can wrap up, Kathleen mentioned about building a relationship of trust, and this is definitely what we're trying to do with KIA, with this outreach. It's a way in which we establish a relationship with our expatriate community, with the diaspora, whereby we can have an ongoing discussion, and we would like to see that grow. And they are able to use Twitter, they're able to use Facebook, they're able to use all of the tools, the web tools that they have available to them. They're able to grow in a way in which they feel comfortable and in which they feel comfortable acting with us. But already we're seeing a lot of benefits from this in terms of setting up programs for our Prime Minister, for example. We can tap into these networks where all of a sudden we're able to access people we didn't even realize existed. Because these people are coming to us and saying, we've heard that the Prime Minister is coming. Let me tell you about these people that I know that would be really interesting for New Zealand to have a closer association with. And as people on the panel have already discussed, it covers a broad network in terms of those contacts, it's capital investment, it's all sorts of things. But from a personal perspective, one of the really positive things is the cultural aspect. Because you really need, in terms of that, going back to the issue of relationship of trust, you need to be able to sit down with people and have a meal with them. You need to be able to converse across the dinner table. And at that point, you then start to be able to expand the relationship and tap into some of the areas that, for at least for the government, are part of our national interests, that looking at economic growth, looking at the influence that we have in the world. So even for a developed country like New Zealand, this is a fantastic resource that we will be sort of looking at this, and we undertook a review of our KIA model only a few years ago. That there'll be another review, I'm sure, that in the future. And we will be trying to move with the times, like many of you in the room, that we will also be looking at the ways in which we can engage with our diaspora. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Todd. That was really a fascinating overview. I very much appreciate your sort of pointing out that diaspora relations are not just something for developing countries. And we've seen this again and again, that countries like New Zealand, like Ireland, Chile, many sort of middle-income and highly developed countries are also regarding their diasporas as critical resources. And another thing you pointed out, which is so important, is that diaspora relations are and must be a two-way street, that it's not just something that's sort of handed down from government, but really needs to develop on sort of both sides of that relationship. So thank you. And now we turn to Pawan Thampipat and come back home to Thailand. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kathleen, Delphine, and Bruce, Andrew, for the invitation for me to be here. I have to say I read the book. I really did. Probably because it's part of my job to do the reverse brain drain and be part of it because I'm interested. I have to say the book was well written, very well written. It was rich. It is rich in information. Different programs, mechanisms, and also policy directions were well researched and categorized, especially with the explicit numbers presented. And that really helps, because until you see it concrete, then you don't really recognize importance. And you can see by reading the book that there was lots and lots of work behind the scene. And to narrow it down or shrink it down to this little tiny book, and that's impressive. For me, being in the government, I see that practical advice, which is available for the policymakers and also practitioners, are available. And for those who wish to engage in the diaspora's policy. But at the same time, I want to encourage the private sectors to read this book, because you find that it is very, very useful, especially for us entering the AEC 2015. Or ASEAN Economic Community, when we will need skilled and quality laborers to enter this competitive era in the knowledge-based society. Now, having said about the book, I'll come back to me and also the current reverse brain drain under the National Science and Technology Development Agency in the Ministry of Science and Technology. I am one of the reverse brain drain products. I'm one of the Thai professionals working overseas in the U.S. Before returning here 6 years ago. I was in the U.S. 23 years. After I finished my PhD program, I was working as a professional in industry, literally in industry. Never worked for academics or government before. So this is a switch, right? Being in industry in the U.S., it gave me a lot of experience, and also it was a great training ground for me to come back to the government. And I recognize by being in the government that we need people with experience in industry to be in the government side of it, because otherwise, you know, it's going to be policymaker without understanding of the real practice. I came back through the reverse brain drain program, which I will share with you a little bit how it comes about. In 1990, when the Thai economy was booming, there was a great need of Thai talents overseas, right? We wanted to hire or attract Thai professionals overseas to come back to industries. At the same time, industries also wished for the universities to produce a lot of qualified people for industry. And it was a catch-22, you know, domino effect. So there was a need, real need by industry and by universities to attract the best and the brightest overseas. And it was more or less a non-governmental initiative until 1996, when this concept of reverse brain drain was formalized by the Ministry of Science and Technology. It was proposed to the cabinet in 1996, and it passed. The cabinet approved in 1996 to have the formal program of reverse brain drain and to be administered and managed by by NASDA, NSTDA, or National Science and Technology Development Agency. However, if you remember 1997, back then I was still in the U.S., there was a economic crisis, really severe one, started in Thailand that, you know, escalated through Southeast Asia. And that changed or altered the faith of the reverse brain drain project. And whatever the glamour that we put on the paper, it didn't come true. It altered completely from the numbers, rigid numbers of a lot of permanent returns to more or less temporary returns or brain circulation or literally virtual return, just circulate ideas over the internet, for example. But we keep the RBD or reverse brain drain program going. It's been now 15 years under NSTDA, and we have a team there, RBD, doing that. And I came into the picture in 2006 when I at that time, in 2004, I was working in the U.S., contemplating of changing my career from for-profit to non-profit. And two choices, right? Academics or government. Government was literally not in the picture. It came when the Thai colleague asked me to submit a application for a position at NSTDA. I did, and I was called for an interview in 2005. I flew in, and I was given a position. In 2006, I literally uprooted from the U.S., sold my home, my cars, and moved back. 2006, I took a position at Nanotech, and it was a term limit. So 2008, I came to the headquarters, NSTDA, and took the current position 3 years ago as a vice president of international relations and communications, looking after the reverse brain drain project as well as the other international corporations for NSTDA. Going through this 3 years program, we worked through three associations of Thai professionals overseas. One is one is called ATPAC, which is ATPAC, Association of Thai Professionals in Canada, in America and Canada. And we have ATPER and ATPITCH, ATPER in Europe and ATPITCH in Japan. With the, as I said, the faith of the RBD program was altered since 1997. So therefore we have limited budget and also limited, we have constraints. We have difficulties as I said, mentioned, because we are in the science and technology element. And I want to mention that because we are a developing country, science and education is vital to our competitiveness and our growth. To make it sustainable, we need S&T and also I innovation in these days, right? Even though we work as a brain circulation program, we also have incentive for a package for those who want to do a short stay in Thailand. We have that offer for the overseas experts. the package is quite, and to me, it's not, compared to the U.S., of course, not the most attractive, but compared to the Thai colleagues, it's quite nice. And we want to see that happening more, but as I said, it's a difficult program, and we don't see a high number in doing so. I want to go to touch on the roadmap. You mentioned trust. You mentioned relationship. That's a key element. People are people at the end, is people, and you need to earn their trust. Trust is earned, not entitled. So we have, and it's important for us to have face time with these people in the three associations in Europe, in the US, and also in Japan. By doing so, we have every 2 years a Thai professionals conference. And the last one this year was actually last week. And the theme of this year is so timely, and it is disaster risk management, lessons learned from the United States, Europe, and Japan. And we had a room full of about 200 people in a conference, and we discussed at great length how we want to see the country prepare for the floods, for example, and the other disasters. We discussed at great length, and we have a list of concerns that we will pursue making collaboration after this. The good thing is that we have also our minister, Dr. Pratap Suryavanshi, who opened the conference and also gave a special talk, a room full of media as well and press. We were through our network of ADPAC, we were lucky to have a keynote speaker from the U.S. who is the director of U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, who has the hands-on experience and lessons learned on the Katrina and Missouri River disaster and recovery. And also she shared with us the lessons learned and how the plan that they implemented in New Orleans to protect New Orleans for the next 100 years. And we were very lucky to have her. I want to end with my observations, because in the past 3 years I'm doing this program, Reverse Brain Drain. It's a very difficult project. And we recognize and why it is. And there is not an easy solution or easy way to go about increasing it. And at the moment, it's a brain circulation, bottom up project based with R&D mainly. And the funding comes from national and international sources. So my attempted answers lie in my following observations. The first one is that Thailand is not an engineering society. We're not. Therefore, this alone presents very little incentive for Thai talents in this profession to consider returning full-time, right? The second observation is that Thailand is one of the best places to live. We have lots of expats from all over the world here. So it's easier to hire the expats to do the work or for the skills that or productivity the employers desire. And also, we have a long history of sending out Thai students overseas for higher education, and most of them return either by family obligations or by the bonding with the government. So because they return, they keep their relationships with their advisors or colleagues intact. With that, they do not need to go through the reverse brain drain program to get help. So with that, I want to end with, now that we are at the point where the policy of looking east is strong, since the global crisis started in the U.S. in 2008, or Europe, and with the AEC 2015 approaching, we hope, and I hope, to see more and deeper engagement with diasporas over the range of the global and local issues. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much, Nopawan. It's Thailand really has a unique experience and a long experience. Must be one of the first systematic programs for return of talent put up by a national government. It's very interesting to hear both the ups and the downs. One of the things that we tried to include in the handbook was not just the happy stories, not just the success stories, but some of the pitfalls as well. Because one can learn a lot from programs that don't work exactly as expected and some that don't work at all. Now for the fun part, and that is your observations, questions. We'd love to hear from your experiences. I see that there are lots of people from other countries than Thailand or New Zealand or the Philippines or the U.S. in this country in the room. And we invite you to give us your reflections or your comments on some of the things we've been talking about. Please, don't be shy.
Is this on? Yeah. Hi, I'm Marwan Makunmak, a journalist for IPS. This probably is to the author. You've made references to the fact that traditionally remittances have been used for day-to-day expenses by families, and there's a need for a shift to use the funds that Asian countries, I would like to ask the question in relation to Asian countries, how these funds could be used, say, for instance, to offset a drop in FDI and ODI. Or, for instance, the book makes reference to probably even using some of these funds to strengthen local capital markets. Can you give me an idea about the kind of conversation that's gone on in the Asian region to seriously look at this? I mean, it's one thing in terms of a policy prescription. We've known for years that these monies have been used to build houses to pay off the debt that people had to pay. But you're talking of something more broader and more substantial and probably relevant in light of what has happened with the financial crisis and the current crisis in Europe. So in the Asian countries, among governments and policymakers, what is the serious level of conversation to use these funds to offset or balance drop in FDI, ODI, and even towards capital markets investments? Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for your question. I think that we have to, in the discussion, try to differentiate remittances from any other forms of finance that members of the diaspora do bring to their countries of origin. So when we use remittances, at least in a policy framework, we refer to private money that is being transferred from one family to their households back to their countries of origin. And that private money is huge, over $400 billion in worldwide, I think $200 billion to Asia alone. And that is a big amount of money, considering even more than the official development assistance that countries actually get. And the question for policymakers is, how do you tap into that resource? What we found in the discussion of remittances is that, first of all, it is private money, and a lot of governments realize that it's better to do no harm and try not to dip their hands into that pot of money and try to enable the migrants to actually use it much more effectively. So the focus of governments now is not to tax remittances. We've seen some of that efforts early on. Pakistan, for instance, have done that. But actually to do the opposite, which is to incentivize migrants to send more remittances through formal channels by actually not taxing remittances, by even providing some incentives, by trying to lower the cost of sending remittances abroad. There's also been some efforts among governments to try to see how can these transfers be linked to some activities. So, for instance, one interesting product that's being piloted, for instance, in the Philippines and in India, is remittance-backed mortgages. So, the access to housing is a big issue for a lot of people in this part of the world. And how do you actually allow migrants to get to housing and to get financing, for instance? And there are now programs, government side, and also matched by the private sector, that allows migrants that receive remittances to actually say to the bank, listen, I receive $400 or $500 every month. Look at these transactions. Can you please provide me a mortgage based on that and use that as my credit history? And that project has been piloted, as I said, in the Philippines, in India. Mexico has done this in a very large scale. And it's one of those initiatives. But ultimately, it is enabling migrants to do what they wanted to do with remittances and to give them as much flexibility in that option. Because at the end of the day, especially for migrants who are sending remittances to their homes, some of these remittances are actually quite small, and they're actually being spent just on meeting daily activities. And it's better for governments to try and make sure that the migrants get as much of that remittances as possible. So number one, do no harm, and number two, give as much options for migrants to make use of that remittances.
Yeah, I entirely agree with the things that Dublin has pointed out, and let me just add one or two things. Some of the financial mechanisms that both encourage people to send more remittances and encourage perhaps more productive use of remittances that people do send, include things like offering a wider range of investment vehicles that are suitable for people of modest means, even for the poor. So one of the reasons I think that remittances are primarily used for consumption or for the most obvious kind of investments, like building a house, buying agricultural land, buying livestock, are that poor people have very few options for investment. You know, the things that they can see, things they can get their hands on, are about the only things that they can really trust. So small rural banks, cooperative banks, and so on, that do offer other kinds of investment vehicles, including products like microinsurance, programs that link remittances, that allow migrants to control the remittances directly rather than, you know, sending them to a member of the family who may have different priorities, is another sort of set of experiments that's ongoing now. On the sort of macroeconomic scale, there is a lot of interest in diaspora bonds as a way of bringing in more investment from migrants, and that is particularly relevant to your question. You know, how do you encourage migrants to send more money that may replace a drop in foreign direct investment or a drop in overseas assistance? Countries have typically turned to bonds precisely at those times when other forms of foreign inflows have dried up. India, for example, pioneered its diaspora bonds at the time just after it had made its first atomic test and was under sanctions as a country that hadn't signed the non-proliferation treaty and was pursuing nuclear armament. To get around those sanctions, they offered a series of bonds to the Indian diaspora, and later, that was the first bond issue, but later did others. Currently, a number of countries that lack access to international financial markets, like Ethiopia, Greece, is now sort of at least discussing the possibility of a diaspora bond. Turkey has issued a diaspora bond. There's several other countries that have reached out in that way. Another vehicle is private, sort of both public and private, securitization of remittance flows. Remittance flows are very stable compared to other kinds of financial flows. When you see foreign direct investment, for example, when there's a financial crisis, we'll just drop off a cliff and then maybe go way back up when things stabilize and then go back down. But remittances stay remarkably steady. Migrants make real sacrifices even when their own incomes drop to keep sending that often relatively small proportion of their own income in the form of remittances. And so countries have actually used the stability of that flow to persuade credit ratings agencies to improve their credit ratings so they can borrow at lower rates on international markets. Private banks even have used this mechanism when they can show that they have a steady inflow of funds from abroad, from migrants abroad, to improve their ability to access international credit markets. So there are a wide range of instruments that are being used, that are being contemplated by countries that haven't used them yet, that really take advantage of the size and stability and predictability of remittance flows.
Hi, I'm Adam Usery, a recent graduate of the University of Washington, Jackson School of International Studies. And many of my friends at the university are second or third generation migrants from Southeast Asia, and are eager to reconnect with their origins, but have never really had an opportunity or reason to do so. Is there anything being done to attract these people back?
Thank you. Very good question. Do you want to either New Zealand or Thailand want to comment on that before we do?
Well, I'm glad to hear that. We do not have a formal program, but you know, in the Thai way, Thai culture, anything's possible. If you see an opportunity to do the bottom up. What I can speak with you afterwards, get the connection. As I said, for me, being back 6 years, I look for, like, I do gap analysis all the time. When I see a little gap, like what you just said, which is not in a formal program, and I will see the possibility is feasible, because I'll tell you, we always want talents here. And I emphasize, and we always talk with the team that being a developing country, what we need most is this good science manager, literally middle management, good science manager. I come from industry. Being in the government, I see scientists, lots of scientists in Thailand, very talented scientists. But at the management level in science, we don't have good ones here. And that's what we need most. And then I say that from my own experience. So if there is a next, well, you know, generation or those who don't speak Thai anymore who want to touch back with that root here, I'll be more than happy to talk with you afterwards and get the contact.
Well, I think engaging the second generation is one of the most difficult types of diasporas for governments. And that is, I was just in Jerusalem, and the Israeli government, that is for them the priority. How do you actually keep Jewish diaspora, the second and the third and subsequent generations, linked to Israel? And that is a question to many of these long-standing diasporas. And we've seen quite a number of programs. One interesting approach is this sort of birthright programs that would actually allow the second generation to go back and return for like a two-week study tour of the country. The Philippines has it, and they call it Lakbay Aral, which means study tour, where they actually have the Filipinos choose them, give them, provide some funding for them, and then make them stay in the Philippines for 2-3 weeks, let them see what it's like. This second generation, third generation Filipinos living in the United States don't usually speak Tagalog. They don't know anything about the country. They have never been home. And so for the Philippines, just to even expose them and see this is what the Philippines is about, see if you like it, is an important first step. And there has been a number also programs that tries to work with existing organizations of young people. And Cyprus, for instance, is a very, very interesting program, which I think we should start looking at, which actually tries to build Cyprus associations of second generation in many different parts of the world where they are in, and engage them directly, meaning the government talking directly with this young people, and trying to get them into the types of conversation that they would be interested in, investing even in social media, for instance, and putting Facebook accounts. You see governments doing that, and providing language training and language classes at embassies is one typical response. In other words, the goal is to try to get them in, and I think that is for many governments, it's an important sector of the diaspora and a very, very hard market to target. So I'm glad to hear that there's one very eager participant here, because we governments need you, basically.
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm not aware of very many programs in Southeast Asia, although Dublin has mentioned a lot of countries are experimenting with the sort of birthright tourism programs. A number of countries are cultivating sort of genealogy tourism or sort of roots tourism. And often these programs are run not at the national level, but by local governments, sort of provincial or municipal governments. And I think that's a topic which we sort of allude to, but really don't go into very much in the handbook. But there is a great deal going on at the level of local government, particularly in China, for example, in Vietnam, where governments have been fairly slow to come to systematic sort of diaspora programs at the national level, but local governments have been cultivating native sons and daughters for a long time. There's even a there's even sort of a graveyard tourism where people are invited to come back and choose a grave site because they want to be buried in the motherland. You know, there are internship programs in the private sector. There are lots and lots of sort of alumni programs where colleges and universities are invited back, not just their graduates, but their the families of their graduates. And I think it's a segment of sort of diaspora policy that governments in this region and every other really should be paying a lot more attention to than these sort of rather scattered programs that we've presented in the handbook. So thanks for that question.
James Gomez from Thammasat University. I just wanted to kind of critically engage the notion of diaspora.
Sure.
What about, I mean, the assumption is governments like all their diaspora, and which is, of course, a very big assumption. We talked about qualified diaspora. I mean, where does your sort of report stand in terms of the unqualified diaspora? I mean, I think that's a question that needs to be asked. And secondly, I mean, even if you're qualified and perhaps politically undesirable, where do they stand? And I just wanted to get a reaction. I mean, we need to have the both sides of the story, I suppose. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, it's an excellent point, and I think we do acknowledge in the introduction to the handbook that this is not all a happy story. That there are diasporas that contribute to perpetuating civil conflicts in their countries of origin. That are exclusive in their nature in a way that encourages divisions within the society at home, that indeed often perpetuate political conflict long after the time when people actually still living in the country of origin have sort of moved on. In the United States, we find, for example, and I say this as MPI, which is a private and non-political organization, so IOM can't be blamed for anything I say, but that the Armenian diaspora in the United States, for example, is much more militant on the conflict with Azerbaijan and on the conflict with Turkey than Armenians living in Armenia are. And in fact, I think Armenia is the only country that I know of that gave diaspora members the vote initially and then took it back because they found like that the diaspora was voting for measures that they didn't have to live with themselves, but that imposed considerable burdens on the population in Armenia. So you're very right to point out that relations with between government and diaspora are by no means smooth sailing all the time, that they're often conflictual. That's one of the reasons why we place such importance on the element of building trust and recognize its difficulties. But thank you for that question.
Yeah. It was a much cited book by Professor Saxenian maybe about 10 years ago, where she introduced the concept of brain circulation. And the book has many very interesting case studies. One I remember was about Taiwan.
Yes.
Taiwan has a very, very successful program of engaging diasporas. And I remember, you know, that one of the elements was to provide a lot of incentives to these professionals to come back to Taiwan. And they tried to generate an environment that was similar to the one they experienced, you know, in U.S. or in Europe, which sounds very, very challenging and difficult. But on the other hand, I mean, for a program like that to be successful, you probably need a critical mass. I mean, if you have just maybe around, you know, 50 professionals or 50 scientists, it might not be enough. So I just would like to know your opinion, first about, you know, if there is a critical mass for this program to be successful, and second, what type of incentives are the most important for cases like this? Thank you.
Thank you. The book the gentleman is referring to is called The New Argonauts by Professor Annalise Saxenian, and it is a really seminal work in the field of skilled diasporas.
I can share from the little I know on Taiwan and Korea, because we monitor Taiwan and Korea closely, and they are our role models, but we can't. We want to be like them, but we can't. Taiwan, everyone knows that they picked the model of technology from the U.S. They bought the technology or licensed technology from the U.S. They picked semiconductor, right, from back then, and seed that with people and also the connection with the U.S. and now become a stronghold of one of the top economies in the world. But Korea, to me, similarly, is closer to my own experience, because when I was a postdoc at the University of Akron, which is known for polymer sciences, there were 200 Korean students in the University of Akron doing polymer science, and that was in 1988. We talk about 200 Korean students, and now, because that the government put them there, get them trained in polymer science, and they come back, and literally they propagate. They have well-trained people back to the country. And now Korea is one of the forefront, right, in the world in terms of engineering. And look at Samsung, right? Take over Sony and with the flat television. That's one example. With that, if you look, it's close to my organization, because back in 1980s, right, 80s, when the U.S., you say it, right, helped the Korean government with this S&T. And from then become KSIT, KIST, right? 10 years later, the U.S. did the same thing with Thailand, with the STDB, Science and Technology Development Board, in 1990, early 1990, 10 years after Korea. And 1985 when it was STDB. And 1991, NASA was born, right, conceived. But Korea already now is the 10th best economy in the world, and Thailand is still the 20-something, right? S&T is something that it's a long-term investment, and also, as you said, critical mass, and we don't have that.
Todd or Devlin, do either of you want to come in on this?
I think that the question of what types of incentives would actually interest diasporas to return is a very big question among policymakers. How much incentive are you going to give to the diaspora? I mean, the Taiwanese during the 1960s gave quite generous incentives. This is not just about salary. It's about providing access to schools and providing really good Western type kind of high upsing. They have an industrial complex where actually the members of the diaspora could create this critical mass. And so what we found, at least in our study, and I think in many of the return programs of IOM, is that, there are many other aspects that diasporas would be interested in, and salary is just one of them. For them, access to networks is an important. Making sure that their careers could actually flourish is an important thing. Even access to children's education. We had a project in Afghanistan, IOM did, and one of the evaluations found that for many of those who are thinking of returning from Europe, the question that they wanted to ask is, how about my children? Because I wanted to bring them with me. These are incentives that I think we should start thinking about, because there are a lot of interest, but what type and how much can you get? And also, not to mention the fact that sometimes if you give a lot of incentives to these diasporas, it might actually create some resentment at the local population. And we've seen that also in our research. So for instance, in China realized that it has to be very aggressive in engaging the diaspora. And it created according to the academics, a bad blood between those who've actually returned, called the sea turtle faction, and those who have actually stayed, called the land turtle faction. The land turtles don't like the sea turtles returning because they're given special benefits. But what's interesting is that I've made recent interviews with scholars in China, some in the governments, and they are saying that the tension has been actually going down. And it is because of the fact that the land turtles see the value in the sea turtles. They see that the sea turtles are actually bringing in resources to the land turtles, and the land turtles are actually going out. They're now migrating as well. And so the incentives that the returnees actually receive, which is quite a lot, seems to be justifiable. I think the question really is to identify what would depend on the country and how much they think they should invest It's a very tricky balance to find.
Just a little, because I was one of the land turtle, sea turtle, one of those. And I understand, I experienced similar things when I returned. But actually, incentive for me, I would share with you, for returning is not materials as the others, because Thailand doesn't work that way. Thai culture is very, very delicate. But what the reason for my returning was the stage for me to perform, the opportunity for me to grow, to contribute, was the attractive incentive for me.
In terms of trying to attract people back to New Zealand under the programs that we currently have, most of that's simply through information dissemination, information that updates people about the current job market, lifestyle, etc. So giving people a more up-to-date perspective on life back in New Zealand. As far as I'm aware, there's no sort of active incentivization as such. Also, too, this is part of a larger migration story, whereby we also have a lot of skilled migration coming into New Zealand from other developed and sort of in developing countries. And so in terms of trying to fill particular gaps within our sort of our economy, either in skilled or semi-skilled areas, we also have that option, as opposed to trying to encourage people to come back.
Yes, and I think that the programs that Annalise Saxenian writes about, and the countries that she writes about particularly, these were programs as much as anything of acceleration of development, of sort of not waiting to develop your own system of higher education. I mean, Taiwan, for example, virtually outsourced higher education in the 1960s to the United States while they were building up first elementary education, then secondary education. In that period, which was a critical asset that lots of developing countries neglect, is building up education from the bottom up. But during the time they were doing that, they outsourced higher education to the United States virtually. China did something similar, particularly with science and technology education. And at the beginning, in the sort of 60s and 70s, when China was, even in a period of worse relations with the United States, was sending so many students to the United States, and only 10% of them were returning. But the Chinese were very relaxed about that at the time, because I believe they had confidence that 10, 20 years down the road that they would be ready to employ people who had acquired those sets of skills, and indeed they were. All of those programs required very heavy investment on the part of government. It's really not to be underestimated how high the commitment was to both to educating students abroad and to building up the industrial parks, the laboratories, the universities that would be able to employ those skills eventually. And they did very cleverly use non-financial incentives as well. I mean, giving someone who was an assistant professor at an American university his or her own lab in China, or a chair at a Chinese university. And very critically also, I think, not insisting that they come back permanently or that they come back full-time, realizing, you know, that was such a big step, particularly for people who had raised families in the United States, who would say, come for 3 months, teach a course, train lab assistants. You don't have to come back permanently, just come. In fact, China changed its slogan from return to serve the motherland to just serve the motherland. And so these were all, you know, very, very intelligent, critical elements. Not that the process was without flaws and without false starts. If you forgive me for just a second, I realize that I neglected to respond to the gentleman from Tamasat's question about less skilled, unskilled diasporas. And I do want to emphasize that they too have a very important part to play. If you look at the experience of Mexico, for example, where the majority of Mexican migrants in the United States are low-skilled are high school graduates or less have high school graduation or lesser qualifications, nonetheless have played extremely important parts in the development of their own sort of towns and villages and regions in Mexico, partly through the power of remittances, but also partly through the power of their organization. They've become real political forces in some parts of Mexico that are very sort of intensive sources of migration. So they too play a part. Thank you, madam.
My name is Mira Kim, a Korean migrant to Thailand for 40 years now. But actually, I was born in North Korea, and my parents migrated down to the south when I was about 100 days old. Mm-hmm. So twice migrant. And I agree with Dr. Nokpoman that I'm very happy here instead of being in Korea. Well, because I was supposed to go to U.S. With a scholarship, but I decided to marry a Thai gentleman in Seoul, and I went to U.S. much later, but I thought maybe it was a fate, but I think I'm much happier here. By the way, Dr. Nokpoman, actually, in 1970s, we were under Park Chung-hee's regime. And I went to the best girls' high school, and more than half of my friends, after marriage, migrated into U.S., North America. See? So we have to classify here students when they're like you. And my ex-friends, alumni, went to U.S. with their young families and whose children became, you know, right. Anyway, that's the point I would like to remind Dr. Nokpoman. And I would like to assure Dr. Nokpoman that I am living in number some 20 country economically, then number 10. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your experience.
Hi, my name is Nicholas Talevsky, and I like to see myself as an American Macedonian, which actually was a very interesting journey that I went through throughout my life to come to that, because I was wondering what I was, having lived in both places. My question actually emanates from that experience, and even my first professional specialization was in migration and diasporas. But my question is, in my work, I found that there's a very strong a tendency to pigeonhole the contribution, to actually quantify it and to put it in a very specific framework. Professor Gomez mentioned that it's, we're looking at R&D from natural sciences to help us become a version of Silicon Valley, but our version. Or we're looking for a doctoral expertise to help us overcome rural health problems that we're facing, whatever it may be, infant mortality, etc. And the interesting aspect that I see is I guess the question to the authors first and foremost, but also to the representatives of the international organizations and the New Zealand government and the Thai government, to see what is the actual space for the contribution of the diaspora communities in the construction of the national identity and the national framework of governance itself. Because I find that very often in the process of building trust and the way that the needs are defined, there's this interaction between a perceived monolith or a mothership, and there are turtles that are leaving and returning and going, and there's this communication. But actually, in my experience, and I'm sure in your study, there is especially when you're dealing with big countries with huge diasporas or proportionally diasporas that have a large, significant impact on the micro or the macroeconomic level in the country, these entities are an entity in their own right, and they're not from sending country or receiving country, but there's some unique mixture in between, and it has to do with social, it has to do with age, it has to do with many, many other elements. And usually the mechanism used most often is community, a church or local community centers, or very often for actual participation, there are the political, like voting or like diaspora representatives. But I don't find that these actually encapsulate the needs. They're not actually communicating them, and they're not facilitating the impact that a diaspora can have in transforming political governance, transforming rule of law in these countries. And for some of them, sorely needed capital that they cannot access. So what did, essentially, to summarize, what was your, in these conversations, what were some of the interesting ideas maybe that worked to get that across?
Well, it's a complex issue. It takes us back a little bit to our sort of earlier question about the sort of tensions between diaspora and government. Of course, there are many governments who don't wish their diasporas to have any political role, and particularly don't want them to have a role in bolstering rule of law and human rights and so on. And that that is certainly a very long process of give and take, building communication, and one hopes building trust over the very long term. And that, I think, is particularly true for countries that have recently been through major political transitions, or indeed revolutions, or are emerging from armed conflict. In a country like South Sudan, for example, the diaspora has been extremely active in helping to write the constitution, in staffing ministries, in really trying to establish a political culture that is sort of progressive and rights oriented, in the face of an experience of war that has not in any way been conducive to sort of fostering those values. And I expect, as a member of the Balkan diaspora, that some of those issues resonate with you as well. It's a constant source of tension, I think, in some countries. And one in which I think the diaspora, if their efforts are not welcomed by government, particularly their efforts to build a sort of new political culture, have recourse to very, very powerful instruments, social media, direct communication, recruitment of younger generations in the country of origin into this sort of nation building and identity building process. I think governments that are intelligent and thinking for the long term will sort of get on, will try to get on board with that efforts, or at least co-opt it. But it's there's no easy answer to your question, except that diasporas have as much of a role as they are dedicated to seizing for themselves.
As I said, our program is more of a brain circulation. Therefore, the impact is a bit more long-term, and we see more the impact, I would say, process, outcome, and impact in the education area more. Since the government, or since the Thai government, turned vocational schools into universities, the curriculums need to be implemented or need to be upgraded, and we have lots of help from diasporas in the U.S., helping us with the curriculum with the new universities. So we will see that more. But at the same time, for science, technology, and innovation, it's more of a bottoms up and kind of individual projects. So it will take some time before we see more. But I expect to see a bigger wave or deeper impact or deeper momentum when we enter the AEC 2015. And can I take this moment to say a few words on the Korea thing? actually, the speaker earlier said is right, because when what I said about my colleagues in the university, that was an after impact when Korea outsourced the education. But at the same time, we also were in 1960s, the wave of the immigrants from Korea in the U.S. returning to Korea. And those I am aware, because we have them as our advisors in the policy office, how they make Korea back then work. And we try to copy their reverse brain drain, but we cannot.
I think the issue that you raise about the space for diaspora in terms of the national identity is a fascinating one. And to take off my government hat on and put it on sort of the hat of a former life, I worked in Bosnia during the war, that from 1992 through 1995, and saw sort of two interesting sides of the diaspora. In 1992, I met a lot of young men who came from diaspora communities from Canada, from Australia, the United States, other parts of Europe, who were prepared to kill and prepared to die for, quote-unquote, their side. And these sides, sort of, in terms of meeting these young men, these were all of the different sides. But they really couldn't articulate in some ways what it was that differentiated them from themselves from sort of the other groups. And they brought, in a sense, a perspective of national identity which had come from Yugoslavia from the 1940s through the 1970s. A few years later, I saw another wave of diaspora that came in who were really keen after the conclusion of the peace accords in 95. They were keen to come into the country and see what it was that they could do to help. But by that time, the situation had become so difficult and so polarized that there wasn't any space for them. And there really wasn't any inclination on the part of the government at that time to engage with the diaspora and to be able to take sort of the value that they can contribute, especially around things like governance, rule of law. And I think it's a fascinating question. I think it's an unanswered question, and it's an unrealized issue. I think that the diaspora can play a very positive role, especially in post-conflict situations, but it's very much up to the part of the authorities that to reach out, or at least, as you say, create the space in which people can come back and provide some benefit.
Briefly to Dr. Lokawan, the background of Korean migration into U.S. in 70s was because of extreme financial difficulties. So you see, then Korea was much poorer than Thailand and the Philippines. That's all.
Thank you.
My name is Ching Nong Tai, and I'm from Taiwan. Yes, I'm Ching Nong Tai from Taiwan, and I did not migrate to Thailand, but I'm only visiting Thailand. I would like to add up some of these Taiwan's success stories you have mentioned. And actually, I have a book chapter on this issue. And I think, as most of you all know about all the incentive programs and the whole range initiatives to attract the return of the talents. But what I would like to say is, to emphasize is, exactly you have put in your book is building up the trust and the connection building work between the country of origin and the diasporas or the overseas talents. And for that reason, actually, we even set up a cabinet level of agency, the National Science Council, and then another one, Commission of Youth Affairs, to in charge all this business. But I am not going to get into that details. I would like to mention here that actually behind the Taiwan's success story, one very important factor is good time matching. In the sense that, as you said, the Taiwan students move to the United States and other countries for advanced training in the 50s and 60s. And then by the mid-early 1980s, they are all in the in their career development stage, they are in the technical track up to the engineer general, very high level in the industry, but they will not be able to be part of the management sector, so they cannot be the general manager or whatever. But the strong economic strength in Taiwan in the 1980s and all the incentives together provide them very, very good opportunity for them to return from the U.S. to join with the Taiwan capital, and then they transfer their career development from the technical track to the management track. And that's echo to the Thai participants, panelists' point that it's very important to have the science and technology personnel to do the good management job. And I think Taiwan, in addition to all this effort and programs, actually is quite lucky in that sense. We joined this together. Thank you.
That's thank you very much for sharing that point. I think it's a really interesting one, that the impact of the sort of glass ceiling on people's careers in the 1980s. I think it had two effects. One is the one you described of encouraging people to return to their country of origin. The other was encouraging people, not just Taiwanese, but Indians, Chinese, others in Silicon Valley, for example, to leave big companies and start their own companies where they would be the head of the company rather than stuck in sort of middle or upper middle management. So two important effects of that limitation on career development.
Can I add something? I can share with you now that I hear something. When I was working for IBM, I was there for 3 years, and I was one of the Asian professionals employed by IBM. And at that time, there were 20% of researchers in IBM labs worldwide, 20% from Asia. And it's a huge number. And a lot are Chinese and Indians. And one of the most one of the researchers in IBM lab at the time has the most patents at age 40. He's Indian, 40 years old. He had 80 patents, which is huge, a lot. And IBM recognized that if they don't promote these Asian people to be at managerial level, they will leave. And they will go somewhere. And that's a brain loss. So what they did, they take just Asian people in IBM and put them in the management training class, like a track. And I was one of them. And then at that time, you know, because they recognize that people want to go through that track of management as a recognition for their success. And by saying this, it doesn't prevent the loss anyway, because the Asians, the Indians, left anyway to go to open their own business or return home for the next career to step in their life. But what I want to share here is that the U.S. companies recognize that as well, and they try to bridge the gap.
Uh-huh. Very interesting. Thank you. If there are no further questions or comments, and I'd like to give our panelists and Dovlin one sort of last word, if you would like one, if there's anything you would like to conclude with, please.
Well, I think just want to say that knowledge changes. Mm-hmm. What we put in here might change, and the knowledge accumulates, and that's why we see this handbook as a living document, and we wanted to be able to go back to this and have the opportunity to review some of the findings and see if it still matters. And so that's why we're taking this effort to disseminate it, because we wanted to get feedbacks from you. So please provide us feedback and provide us information that you wanted to share, because ultimately that is the sharing of information is one of the things that's been lacking. We don't need to start from scratch, and a lot of governments right now are doing that, which is sad. But there is an opportunity to share information and to revise this and go back to this, and we hope that we'll hear back from you and your feedback.
Thank you, Todd. Any last remarks, Todd?
I would simply say that the issue of the diaspora and how that can be reconnected with the country of origin, how it can provide some benefit, and also how sort of we can provide benefit to the diaspora is going to become an increasingly important issue. As the world becomes faster and mobility increases, this is the start of a much larger discussion.
I think what struck me is, and particularly listening to the personal stories of Kun Nopawan and others in the audience of how incredibly complex it all is, because it's individuals in various stages of their careers in other countries, and whether the next step in their career is what they want to do, or whether they think, wow, this is maybe a time where I consider going home. And I think that's a very interesting part of it, that in Kun Nopawan's case, it wasn't financial incentives. It was just at a time of her life when she looked around and said, maybe I'd like to do something in Thailand. So I think that's because because we're dealing with human beings, there are so many reasons why a diaspora's return home, why they suddenly want to link up with their mother country, why they want to provide assistance. So it's an intriguing issue, and I enjoyed the panel. Thank you.
Being one of the returns, I will say that it's what Andrew said is very true. It's a very complex issue. Why people want to do certain things, why people want to return. But for me, the main reason is I am a Thai person. I want to be here at one point of my life. And it didn't occur to me at that time. And it just became at the moment, at turning point. And the decision was not easy. 2 years in the making. And once I decided to do it, that's it, done. And no turning back. And 6 years now, I've been here, and I'm happy to be here. And I want to say that going forward, I want for the private sectors in Thailand to look more into this program, Diasporas, because there is a pool of talents to be tapped.
Thank you. Well, I think my last comment would echo Todd's in a sense, is that I really think that that diasporas, these sort of transnational, more than one country populations, are a very big part of the future. I mean, you look at someone like Dovlin, who has 3 passports, the Philippines, U.S., and Iceland, you know. Now, that's a real citizen of the world and a citizen of the future. And I think we are going to see more and more of this, and more people who don't feel that they have to choose, who can feel themselves comfortably both Filipino and American. I'm not so sure about the Iceland part. I think that's a bit of a stretch, frankly.
I am.
But, you know, this is Dublin Ranveig Agunias. So I really think it is a topic that is going to be more and more on the minds of policymakers, as we have seen over the last 5 or 10 years. So it only remains for me to thank my co-author, who's always such a pleasure to work with, to thank our wonderful panelists who've really enriched this discussion tremendously, and to thank our host in Thailand, Andy Bruce, who has made this so pleasant and productive for us. So thanks to you all, and finally, thanks to all of you for coming and participating in this discussion.
To download for free or purchase a hard copy of the handbook, Developing a Roadmap for Engaging Diasporas in Development, please visit www.thediasporahandbook.org.